Hi there, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to Dog Logical, a podcast by R Plus Dogs. I'm Renee Rhodes, a dog behavior consultant, the owner of R Plus Dogs, and a self-professed dog nerd. Along with my friend and colleague, Cassie Dixon, we host this podcast aimed at dog guardians to give you tips, tricks, and bust pesky myths about your dog and their behavior. So if you want to learn how to be more dog logical, you're in the right place. Now let's dive into this episode. Hi guys, and welcome to the Dog Logical Podcast. Today we have Alexis. Alexis, would you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Renee. Thanks so much for having me. My name is Alexis Devine. Most people probably know me as Bunny the Dog's mom, but I'm a certified professional dog trainer, a family dog mediator, and an artist by trade.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. I'm interested, what kind of art do you do? Because I don't think I've seen so much of that side of you.
Yeah, no, I don't post it so much on social media. I used to, but I was a wearable art designer for several years. I showed at New York Fashion Week. I was sold in boutiques around the country, did a ton of photo shoots. And during the pandemic, you know, there weren't any fashion shows or photo shoots. All the boutiques shuttered. And so I was able to dedicate a lot of time to working with my dog Bunny and learning how to communicate with her and just trying to connect in as many ways as possible. And the shift was kind of slow, but eventually I left that behind me and moved more full time into working with my dogs.
Yeah, it's interesting because I also come from, my mom is an artist and I come from like a background of art. I thought I wanted to kind of dedicate myself to art, and I also made the transition to dogs as well. I think we kind of, I don't know, if I see a similarity of people who are like creative, sensitive, you know, kind of, mm-hmm. I've always been attracted to animals, always been like super interested in animals. And then I think that kind of merges with that creative, kind of sensitive, you know, side of people, which is always interesting to see.
Absolutely. I think there has to be a level of empathy that you have in both, right? Like, I feel like art is a way to explore the unknown about yourself or about the world. And in doing so, you have to really think about and listen to what you're feeling and what you're saying. And the same goes with dog training. You really have to learn to listen quite carefully to the subtle signals, to what dogs are telling you all the time, because obviously in most cases, they don't have words to tell you. So there's quite a bit of creativity in forming a plan in terms of how to move through the world with any given dog, as we know they're all individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that does play into that really, really nicely because, yeah, like I said, that's kind of empathetic side. You definitely, and sometimes you have to be creative when you're working with dogs. Mm-hmm. So that creative side sometimes pops up. You're like, we're going to try this. And yes. Being able to kind of shift and pivot when you're doing things as well. So I think some of that also kind of comes into it. But yeah, that's an interesting, I didn't know that previously about you. So that's a little interesting tidbit for me as well.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Bunny, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes, especially with my dogs, people are like, where's, you know, if I'm working from home, they're like, where's Lycan and Nero? And I'm like, sometimes I think my dogs are like more famous than I am in a sense. Like people are like, what's Nero and Lycan doing? So do mm-hmm. you find that, you know, that's been such a great way for you to connect with people through Bunny and that kind of entity of herself, you know, without really knowing. But how has that been for you?
It's been amazing. Some of my closest friends now are people that I have met online through connections in the dog training world that I've become a part of since, you know, sort of blowing up on TikTok and Instagram. In fact, I'd say most of my closest circle are people that I've been able to connect with through this. So I feel like there's so much negativity on social media, right? As we were discussing just before we went live here, but there's also so many positive things that can come from it as well. The connections, the learning, we really have an ability to impact behavior, not just of animals, but of humans in a positive manner, sort of non-intrusive. In my case, I started my journey not knowing anything about dog training or behavior. And I almost immediately took this super deep dive, learning as much as I possibly could, because I had to, because as Bunny approached social and sexual maturity, I started to see signs of reactivity and I didn't know what that was. And I was like, oh crap, I got to learn some stuff. So I did. It was a steep learning curve. And I, you know, was able to document that whole journey as I learned. So when I found out what enrichment was, I was like, oh my God, you guys, this is so cool. Look, you can do this thing, like crumble up some paper and put treats in it. And, you know, they're learning as I'm learning. So I'm able to put this positive thread of information out there, not so much so like, here's the thing that you need to do, but like, mm-hmm. here's what I just learned. Here's what I'm doing. And I think because that's really approachable for people, it's easy to take that information in and then make something of it. So I found a lot of the community is really on this learning journey with me, and we're all learning together. And I feel like it brings us a lot closer when it's approached that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like you said, I read some of your book already, which I said, like, I'm you know, I can't wait to finish it. I have a weekend in Texas with my niece, and I'm kind of chaperoning her and her boyfriend. So I anticipate that I'm not going to be doing much of anything. I'm like, okay, bringing the book so I can finish it. But that was something that I think a lot of people can identify with, is that, you know, I'm getting a dog. I want to do the best thing I can for this dog. And then, like you said, you anticipate all these things. You have all your ducks in a row, and then something to like happens, like reactivity, and you're like, whoa, like, you know, I've done all the things. Like, why is this not working? Like, what's happening? Did you, when you were kind of on that journey, did you encounter things? How did you discriminate between, you know, like maybe some of the more negative side of training versus the positive? How did you kind of, you know, what was that journey like for you?
That was not a journey at all for me. There was never a question in my mind what type of training I wanted to use. Just, it never even crossed my mind. And I was shocked, actually, when I started to really learn about training and behavior and involve myself more in the community, that there were so many people that were regularly using aversive methods. It never really made sense to me. And I've thought a lot about it, and it doesn't make sense to me personally, but I can see why it makes sense to some people who haven't been exposed to other methods. So, you know, I really try not to bash or be like, you're doing this wrong. I try to show by example, like, this is a technique, a method that's worked really, really well for me and has helped me establish this super connected relationship with Bunny, where we have this beautiful communicative style. And I haven't had to use aversive methods at all. And so that wasn't a part of my journey. And I feel really fortunate to have started learning about training now versus trainers who've been in the business for a really, really long time, where positive reinforcement-based training kind of didn't exist. You know, the methods, except for, you know, in zoos, where that's all they used, but it was all punitive. And I feel quite fortunate to have not been exposed to that from day one. So the choice to train using positive reinforcement was just sort of obvious and natural to me.
Yeah. It's interesting as well, because I was reading, so there's like a really great welfare-based professor who's Donald Broom, and I was reading one of his books, and I kind of have a menagerie of books. So I was reading this book and I was like, you know, this is good, this is good, this is good. And I get to a part and they're talking about pack mentality, and I'm like, what? Like, this is a welfare book, right? And I'm flipping back through and I'm like, no, that, like, he's actually talking about this. And it was really interesting because that was 2007. And if you think about 2007, it doesn't feel that long ago. I mean, yes, it does, but yes, it doesn't. But I was like, wow, look at just that within the welfare circle of, you know, talking about pack and, you know, alpha and dominance and things like that. And yeah, so it would actually, I think that's the thing that people sometimes miss, because I know I get asked a lot for like references and studies for things of ideas that I have come to for not only like, I don't just like pick things out of the air, right? So like, it'll be a culmination of like education, experiences, anecdotal, you know, like things that I've experienced with my own dogs and ideas and understandings about like a welfare and ethology. And then I kind of mash those up into, you know, and I'm a scientist by heart. I really like questioning things. So sometimes people will say like, oh, do you have a study for that? Where's your research? And I'm like, there just isn't, because I don't think people understand that it's still evolving. Science isn't this like stagnant thing. It's a living, breathing organism that grows. And, you know, so it's a great thing. But I think on the flip side of that, when somebody has come from a situation where maybe they have used methods or tactics or, you know, tricks and tips with their dogs that haven't gone the way that maybe they intended them to, or had those repercussions that start to creep in, I always feel empathetic for them, because the information that's out there, I mean, we know, like, we consume the information all the time, is just so sickly of, you know, try this thing and do this thing. And you're like, don't try that thing and don't do that thing. But that's all that's really out there for some people. So it's a relatively new topic, talking about like behavior and cognition and ethology. I mean, when I went back to school, I remember telling my friends like, oh, I want to be an ethologist. And they were like, a what? Like, they didn't know what it was. And I was like, oh, like animal behavior, specifically dogs. And they were like, oh, okay, why don't you just say dog behavior? And I was like, well, really, that's the term. But like, nobody really, and these are animal people. These are like vet nurses and, you know, vets and things. And they were like, man, like, what's ethology? So it is still evolving. Our ideas are evolving and our practices are evolving. And it's a good thing to, you know, have evolution in that regard. But still, there are going to be residual things that we encounter, and some of them are worse than others.
Absolutely. And I can relate when you said it's got to be hard and you have empathy for people who have chosen a method that's different from the method that we choose, because you can Google like how to teach a sit and you can get like five diametrically opposed answers to that. And for somebody like me, who at the beginning of my journey didn't have any basis of comparison, I could understand how it would be really challenging to say, oh God, well, do I lure the dog's nose up with a treat or do I push their bum down? They both work equally well. They both seem, you know, situationally appropriate, and not having that greater understanding of the damage that one could do versus the other, it's really hard. So it makes a lot of sense that there's still, you know, various camps on this. And if a thing has worked for you, as we know, you've been reinforced because it worked, you're likely to try it again. So I think it's so important to just have as many folks as possible leading by example and showing the world what is possible without using those aversive techniques, and how greatly it can benefit relationship, right?
Yeah. And I think that's the thing it really comes down to, that sometimes our skew of what like a good relationship is my dog listens to me versus I listen to my dog and my dog in turn listens to me. It's, you know, it's that kind of, just totally, like you have a relationship with any other human, is that you have that reciprocal behavior. And sometimes there are things that we need to do to keep our dog safe, because, you know, they're the mentality of like a young toddler, and toddlers don't make good changes, good choices. Sorry. So we have to kind of step in and guide in that sense. But I still, you know, my dogs, I listen to them. Sometimes I have to say no in a roundabout way, or maybe later, or, you know, things like that. But it's not a dead, you know, you must listen to me and you're not listening to me. What's wrong with you? And I think those two kind of camps of communication and listening, and what a good dog is versus what a, you know, a bad dog, if there are any bad dogs, is that's the, you know, effective part. And it's hard to change people's mind, because they feel like sometimes, you know, we're talking about that cognitive bias and dissidence, and it's hard to say, well, you know, yes, your dog may listen to you, but are you listening to your dog? Why do I have to listen to my dog?
Yeah, it's partnership versus obedience, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that sentiment. And don't get me wrong, like I've definitely in a moment of panic or frustration yelled at my dogs, like punishment is unavoidable, but it's not my go-to, you know? Punishment happens in life every day, whether we want it to or not.
Yeah.
But in my active interactions with my animal companions, I really, really do try and listen as much as I can so that it's a two-way relationship. It's really a partnership versus, okay, we're doing this now. Yeah. You do this now, you know, yeah. Instead of it's like, oh, you don't want to go for a walk? Okay, you can stay home and I'll go out with the other dogs or whatever.
Yeah. And I think you brought up a great point as well, is like, I think that this positive realm, you know, because I mean, I'm R plus dogs. I don't think people like, you know, I can't get any more positive, but people assume that I don't do anything that my dogs would dislike. I mean, yes, I have to. They're, you know, that is life. There are going to be things that are just a safety issue or a time issue or a me issue, you know. And yeah. Having that two-way communication is, you know, most of the time I'm able to, you know, meet your needs. Occasionally I need to meet my own needs because I'm an animal with my own emotions, with my own emotional bandwidth. And some days or sometimes or some moments, it's like, you know, so I've gotten frustrated with my dogs. I've gotten upset with my dog. Of course I have. It's like any other relationship, really. Mm-hmm. But the overriding theme is that I am aiming everything I can to meet your needs and make sure that, you know, you are living the best life possible. But yes, even, you know, people who use positive reinforcement, there will be moments where you lose your cool, you know, you get upset. There's been lots of times where I've cried about situations, especially with Lycan. Lycan's been a steep learning curve for me professionally and personally. And I've just been like, I just, you know, and I'm lucky in that regard because I have my husband and I can say, you know, Scott, can you deal with him today? Because I just, you know, I just can't today. It's just too much for whatever reason, you know, and he can step in on those days and just say, okay, come on, you know, come with me. Yeah. There are going to be moments where that happens. Does that mean that you're not positive or not, you know, empathetic or things like that? Absolutely not. But it's just a normal part of life. And I think it does get better, you know, for a moment, just go and do something that makes you happy. If you don't want to be around your dog, you know, give them some enrichment, put them in another room, take 5 minutes breather or longer if you need it, you know, take that time for you. You're not a bad dog guardian if you lose your cool and you need a couple minutes or, you know, you're having a small little breakdown in the closet. Everyone's done it.
Absolutely. And I would argue that those moments are important to have happen, right? Because once you see them happen, once you explore what set that situation up for failure or success, you can reevaluate next time and maybe, you know, arrange the antecedents so that there's a more positive outcome for everyone involved, you know? Yeah, like you said, absolutely. Give them some enrichment or, you know, play with them for 5 minutes and then go take a shower. Yeah, exactly.
Mommy needs to cry for a minute. Like, here you go.
Yes, believe me, I have many of those moments and many more. Yeah. I have less now, but Bunny has been a very challenging dog for me. She's reactive. But she's also chronically ill. So she has good days and she has bad days. And her bad days are very, very hard.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about caring for her during a period of time where she is physically unwell and therefore has increased anxiety with as much compassion as possible. Even though it is very hard for me to keep my cool sometimes, you know, her sound sensitivity is through the roof. She's barking at everything and everyone. She has zero tolerance for otter. Her resource guarding goes through the roof. And you know, there are things that I can do. I can separate them, take otter for a walk. I can give her gabapentin so that hopefully she's in less physical pain. There are ways around that that I wouldn't have come to had I not had my own meltdowns in those situations, right? That's natural. We're all humans. We're all sentient beings. And it's learning how to approach those situations in different ways next time that benefit everyone involved.
Yeah. And I think that also kind of plays into anthropomorphism. So like you know, often I think we think of it as, or we're told that it's a really negative thing, but sometimes adding that layer, like you just mentioned about what you experience in those moments where you're stressed out, you know, there was a period at the beginning of the year, this year, where I was really ill for months on end. And that gave me, it's the first time in my whole entire life that I've been that ill, which is a very scary ill. And
for sure,
that was, yeah, that was something where I was like, you know, I always equate it to dogs, but like to be that physically ill from both sides, like, and to have to care for dogs. Again, thankfully I have my husband, but if I was on my own, how would I orchestrate that? You know, and there were lots of days where we did the bare minimum mm-hmm. and the dogs were fine. And there's also times where, you know, I felt okay and I could, but thinking about that from the perspective of the human for me, and then also like being a dog who's chronically ill and having to, you know, endure other things, or having someone who maybe doesn't understand, because there were periods of time where my husband did not understand what was going on. I didn't understand. Nobody really understood what was going on. So, you know, there were moments where he got frustrated with me, and he's the most caring, loving person in the world. But there were moments where he was just like, I'm losing my cool with you because, you know, you can't control your, you know, I'm having outbursts and things like that. And, you know, it's hard mm-hmm. for me to control my emotions. And he's like frustrated, doesn't know what to do for me. And it, I think that's the thing about me, is I always bring it back to like, what would this be like for a dog? But also mm-hmm. that human side of being chronically ill and having to care for your dogs. It's such a eye-opening situation. It was for me to look at from that. The fact that you're mentioning now, because I've seen some stuff about her being ill, and I wasn't really, I try to stay off social media, but obviously I'm on social
smart.
Media. I kind of dip in and out sometimes where I'm like, oh, what's yeah. going on? But looking at that and also the multi-dog household in that situation, because mm-hmm. you have her and you want to dedicate all your time and energy and, you know, helping her to feel better. But then you got, you know, two little other snoots that are like, hello. Which
two little other snoots. Yes.
Yes. Adding another dog to the family for me was, and especially dog like Lycan. Woo. Like that was a steep learning curve for me, because I've had multiple dogs before. But when you added the third dog, I was like, what are you doing? Like,
mm-hmm. a lot of people were like that. Yeah.
Yes.
And I, you know, I truly expected that Bunny would be the challenge there. And, you know, people came for me. They're like, why would you add another dog if you have a reactive dog? And I was like, well, mm. because I know Bunny very well. And yeah. she is fine with new dogs if they're carefully introduced. 3 or 4 parallel walks, and then, you know, give her plenty of alone time, and then she's fine. And she actually became accustomed to Tenrec, my little Papillon, quite quickly. And it was Otter that proved to be more challenging. And it was just like an overabundance of testosterone. But he's neutered now and things are great. go figure. An abundance of testosterone just ruining the dynamic everywhere, right? But yeah, I mean, I think, again, people aren't in my shoes. They don't know my dogs. And same with you. They don't know all of the nuance within your dynamic and your situation.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's hard regardless, adding a new dog, adding a new human, you know, changing the environment in any way can be really, really hard. But if you have the kind of relationship that I think I have with my dogs, it's something that you can work through, because you know everyone so well and you've established that rapport and that trust to the point where you just sort of know. You know what steps you have to take. You know that this might take some time, but that it will work. And that's been the case for us. We take everything extraordinarily slowly, glacial pace, and that's what works. And, you know, I always say it's better to set everyone up for success. And take as long as you need and prevent those negative interactions from happening, then try to fix a relationship that's already experienced some really negative interactions. So
yeah.
That's what we've been doing. And it's going really well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think in our situation, Nero is very like social. He loves other dogs. His tolerance for other dogs is quite high. I don't think we were prepared for Lycan. I think we did everything we can. He actually came to me as a client relinquishment. So There was a really short space of time between me figuring out, you know, or finding out necessarily, or being asked really to take him and us taking him. So it was kind of like, we weren't expecting, we had fostered lots of dogs, and every dog that we fostered, Scott was like, we're not going to keep this dog. Right? Say those words. We're not going to keep this dog. And I was like, we're not going to give this dog ahead. And so we weren't preparing to add a second dog, and he came along, and I had kind of trained him as a puppy. So I knew a bit about him, but I also knew that he had all these challenges, and I was like, I can, you know, do it. And Nier was just like, hey, like, welcome. You know, he really didn't need that much adjusting. And it was really us that were like, okay, like we need to pivot, because he, you know, living with, I think, a dog who is high drive, working dog, living with a dog like that, and I've had shepherds before, but living with a dog like Lycan definitely causes you to pivot, you know, away from, and I hadn't experienced a dog kind of like him, but then it's like, it's not a client dog. You know, I get to walk away from that situation and help coach that client from a distance. Living with it is a totally different situation. And we're amazing. I mean, I would not change anything for the world, but the first couple of years were rough. And like you said, like taking it that glacial pace, that was my relationship with him, where I was like, am I your right human? You know, is this the right scenario? Am I doing all the things? I asked like colleagues, and I like, you know, listed everything that I was doing. And they were like, he couldn't have a better home. And I was like, well, why is it working?
Like, yeah.
Okay. And that was us, was just like slowly just, you know, staying the course. And I mean, I wouldn't trade him for the world now. He's my buddy. But if for us, it was that. So it might not even be the dog scenario, you know, it could be the human.
Yeah.
And we just dedicate. I mean, Scott was like, he's here. He's never leaving. Like he's, you know, he's our dog. He's, you know, we're his people. Where would he go? We cannot guarantee that he would have a good life with anyone else. And that was the thing that really kind of kept me, you know, going in those moments where I was like, I just don't know if I'm the right. And tears, so many tears, but
so many tears.
So yeah, I think it's not for everyone. You know, rehoming a dog is a very individual situation, that there's a lot of factors in it. And, you know, it was something that I had kind of toyed with the idea of doing.
Yeah, but it's often the kindest decision, right? Mm. If you're in a place where you're considering rehoming a dog, it's probably because you know that this isn't the best home for the dog, right?
Yeah.
So finding the best home for the dog is the kindest thing for that dog.
Yeah. And I've been through a lot of like client relinquishments and going into like, you know, to drug service or, you know, going on to live on farms and things like that. And it's just so different when it's you, you know, it's like, I've done all the things, like, you know, what can I do? But I really appreciate you saying that you took a glacier pace, because that's often not what people do. They tend to like get another dog and just, you know, assume that they're going to get, rightly so. I mean, they assume that they're, you know, going to get along because a dog is a dog is a dog. But it's often when they have those altercations, and then it's like, oops, you know, now we're a couple altercations in the mix, which of course makes it more challenging. Dividing up your house, having a glacier pace, being able to take that route, I always feel is the best with almost any sort of interaction with other dogs, even if they get along really well from the start.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And giving them that separation too allows you to really make sure that everyone's individual needs are being met. Which I feel like sometimes in a multi-dog household, it's really easy to sort of, okay, we're all going to go for a walk together. Okay, everyone's going to eat. Okay, I'm going to go do my thing. And then, you know, no one's maybe getting the same sort of individualized interaction that they loved prior to that. So because I'm taking it so slowly, it's been, well, it's not been easy. It's hard to give three dogs the individual attention that I want to be able to provide to them every day. Like, that's next to impossible. But it's been easier in the sense that, you know, they have their own spaces. I can go down and hang out with one I can then take another one for a walk. I can go upstairs and do training with the other. And then they still have some, you know, combined moments throughout the day where they all get to spend their time. I always end on a positive note so that we don't get to a place where everyone's, you know, everyone's arousal is too high or there's the potential for anything negative to happen. And that's been working really well for us. And I'm slowly integrating them more and more each day, you know, outside time on the beach, all three of them together, and then maybe a walk with the three of them later in the day, and then individual training and enrichment throughout the day seems to work well for us at the moment.
Yeah, I think that.
But it isn't easy. It isn't.
Yeah, no. That's why I said when you added the third dog, I was a bit like, how much time do you have? Because two dogs, and I'm like, it's a challenge for me. And like you said, it's not every day. Then I get to meet everybody's need. You know, there might be like
right. The
husband, the, you know, Lycan, the Nero, the Renee, sometimes Gomez the cat, although Gomez is pretty low in like needs. But yeah, it's like not, and then the days where everybody's needs are met, it's like, such a great day. But
I know.
Not every day.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I'm really fortunate that my job ostensibly is caring for my dogs. So I get to do a lot of that throughout the day and I get to explore a lot of different types of enrichment.
Does your dog have big feelings about the world? Do you find that taking them out on a walk is just exhausting? They bark, they lunge, and they pull. And even though you really love your dog, you really don't love their behavior, but you don't know how to help them. Maybe you've tried crowdsourcing your information from the internet, social media, or friends and family, and it's left you feeling frustrated, confused, without a clear way forward. If this sounds like you, good news. You sound like the perfect candidate for my Resolving Reactivity course. This 8-week online course will give you all of the tools that you need to be able to take your dog from reactive to relaxed. You can find the link to grab your spot in the podcast notes. Alternatively, if you're on Instagram, DM me the word resolve and I'll send you the link.
And one thing I find kind of bonkers is that zoos have had this framework of enrichment, right? For meeting their animals' needs for years and years and years. And until recently, it wasn't even discussed in like household environments like ours, right?
Yeah.
And I think being able to frame their welfare through that lens now and really look at, okay, are they getting enough sleep? Okay, have they been fed? Do they have water? Have they been able to sniff? Have they been able to dig? Have they been able to do their favorite activity? Helps me make sure in a chaotic 3-dog household that each of them is at least getting most of their needs met on a daily basis. And it can be really individualized as well. So looking at how I care for them through that lens has been really helpful to me, and it's made it easier for me to sort of organize and structure our daily routine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely see that in my household is the things that there's some things that the boys like doing together, kind of, you know, in equal amounts. And then there are definitely things that they like and their approaches. I like using them as kind of two kind of polar opposites because their personalities are polar opposites. Like Nero's kind of, you know, he's a little sensitive. He can be a little tricky about things, you know, and Lycan's just like, when are we doing it? Let's do it now. Let's do it 5 times, you know, over. Be like, I was telling my niece the other day, you know, Lycan's the perfect dog for children because you'll throw the ball 500 times and he'll be like 501. Like he just like, yeah, let's do it. So yeah. For them, there's different activities that they like, and that requires kind of different parts of me, which is quite nice. But yeah, there's some things we can do together, like going out into the forest and sniffing and moving around and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then there's definitely definitive, like that is a Lycan activity, that is a Nero activity. But
for sure. Yeah.
Something that I've noticed, which is really interesting, and I haven't really talked about it too much besides like with clients and things, but the ability for Nero to start doing activities, enrichment activities that he didn't find engaging before. So with Lycan, he loves shredding, you know, like deconstruction and enrichment, like, you know, just like fuels his fire. And there's been a few times where I've caught Nero kind of going in behind him and ripping things up, or like the whole lettuce thing. You know, there was that kind of lettuce phase where everyone had now it's cabbages so much, but I'm sure it'll swing back around. But
can I just interject for 1 second and say no to cabbage because no to cabbage. Absolutely hard no. Yeah. Okay, please continue.
A client sent me things and I'm like, not the cabbage, like, you know, lettuce, yes, but yes, that's a good PSA. But yeah, there was a situation where I gave it to Lycan, you know, he had shredded up, he came back in, you know, we were just kind of lounging around, whatever. And at the corner of my eye, I saw Nero, you know, throwing something around. He was outside and I realized he was ripping up the lettuce. And I was like, oh my gosh, like this is not a Nero type activity. You know, Nero's very much like destroy it. No, no, we do not do that. So it's interesting because I've seen quite a few examples of that where he's started to kind of open up and explore things that traditionally his personality just wasn't that interested in. So
I love that.
I also
do you put that down to social learning then? He's like, oh, maybe I should explore this or...
I think it's, maybe it's a little bit, although he's not really paying attention. I think when Lycan's doing it, he's like, yeah, you do your thing, boy. I think it's more maybe a little bit of inquisitive, like, what is this? You know, what is going on here? I wouldn't say that he, in the social learning in the sense of like copying him, but more of maybe the food has kind of drawn him. Because the lettuce, I put like treats in it and let him shred it. And I think it's more of like, there was food here and Nero likes food. So Nero's going to explore. And maybe there's a bit of like treat that was left in the lettuce or something like that. Because he doesn't do a lot of social learning in the sense of like mimicking. But that's one aspect that he's kind of picked up on from Lycan. So I think it has to do with the food. Nero really likes foraging. So I think it was that because there's been a couple other activities, like a big box that was shredded with paper and he went back in and he was like, you know, trying to like find the treats in that. So not so much the shredding, but with the lettuce, he did the shredding, which was interesting.
Yeah.
So I think he just couldn't reach the food, but I like that's one of those situations where like, that's kind of like, oh, you know, so I will say to clients or I might educate, you know, the public on saying, offer these things, even if your dog isn't interested in that specific type of enrichment, occasionally offer it and see, you know, have they warm to the idea. And it's through that, through watching Nero specifically engage with those kind of activities that I'm like, you know, it's not like that characteristic of him can shift sometimes. And he's doing it now a little bit more often than he used to do it. And it's slowly kind of evolved but if I give him an activity right off the bat, he usually won't, he'll walk away from it. But if Lycan has been at it before, then he's like, okay, I'll go back and just survey if you've missed anything.
Yeah. So I love that. That's so fun.
Enrichment in a roundabout way.
I love that. Yeah, my dogs are always super interested in what each other are doing or playing with. Otter will, he doesn't use the buttons nearly as much as Bunny does, and he uses them almost exclusively for evil. if she has a bone or a toy, he'll go over to the buttons and he'll press outside, outside, beach. And I'll be like, oh, okay. And he'll run to the door and Bunny will be like, oh, we're going outside. She'll drop whatever she's doing, run to the door. And as soon as Bunny's at the door, Otto will run back and steal whatever she's got. Even if he doesn't want it, even if it's not something he enjoys, right? He enjoys it just because it was hers.
Yeah. Nero does that too. We do phantom barking. So if something is happening and Nero he has something and he's being just that spatial pressure from Lycan, we've noticed that he will bark at something and then he'll kind of hop back and grab it and be like, ha, like got you away. Or our favorite now is we have our chew box. So they have access to chews all the time. And Nero has started to go to the box. And of course, Lycan's like, oh, the box. And then he'll take a chew and he'll drop it off somewhere and then go back, wait for Lycan to get his chew that he dropped. And then saunter over to the box and grab a different one. So he's like, oh, you take that one.
Yeah.
And it's just stuff like that where I'm just like, you are just, we don't give you enough. Like, I didn't teach you that. Like, you taught yourself how to do that and how to figure that out. But I love so those smart. Are the moments I love the most, where I'm just like, oh, like you are so clever.
Mm-hmm. Look at you being a dog. I know. Yeah.
Like those little cogs. He's like, I got you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I tried to introduce the buttons to Nero too, but I think the problem with us is we already had an established communication. So like the pattern communication for him is like a nose boop, or he'll come up and get in my face and like do a little lick, and I'll be like, you know, what do you need? And then what do you need? Show me. And then he'll go and show me to what he wants to do. So when the buttons came, he was like, why would I do this? Like, he just was like, I was trying to show
an extra step.
He was just like, no, this doesn't work for me. Like, and love them, but I didn't have the time to introduce. Yeah. He was just like, outside or play. And I was like,
that sounds familiar.
Yeah. We need to fine tune this a little bit. But I mean, that kind of brings us in the segue of the buttons. Cause I really want to talk about the buttons. But how did those come about? So how did you kind of get into the buttons? Now, I read, like I said, this is the part of the book I read, so I know. But describe kind of how that came to be.
So it was before bringing Bunny home. She's my first dog since childhood. And I'd seen a speech language pathologist on social media that was using them to communicate with her own dog. I had no business teaching my dog how to communicate with buttons because I was not a speech language pathologist or a trainer or behavior expert. But I am frustratingly tenacious, as some people might say. So before Bunny came home, I had an outside button waiting by the door. I'd recorded the word outside on it. And every time we went outside, I'd press the button and say the word outside. And then we'd go outside and we'd have a little outside party. And within a few weeks, she used it herself for the first time. And it was sort of game on at that point. I figured if she could learn one, she could learn two. If she could learn two, she could learn 10. And, you know, 4 years later, we're up to about 100 buttons. And, you know, I didn't have any sort of, there wasn't a box around what I expected to be capable of, because I didn't have any sort of preconceived notions of what wasn't available to me in terms of words. I just wanted to explore with as much curiosity as possible and really let Bunny guide the addition of new words as much as possible. And
I think that's the best way to be, isn't it? To just like not set that expectation in general with our dogs, not set that expectation and to let things kind of naturally evolve to see how far you, because if you do, like you said, that box, you kind of put that box and it's like, okay, well, we've learned all those. That's great. That fits, you know, my need or, you know, whatever I think that encompasses, versus like being like, not only going to open the door, we're going to friggin' like smash it down. Like, where can we go with
Yeah, exactly. And that was exactly the approach I took. I didn't know where we'd go. I didn't have any expectations. I just wanted to see what happened, and all, you know, with the underlying goal of just having the most connected relationship possible. And the funny thing about it, you know, like a lot of people say, just let your dog be a dog. Like, this is so unnatural. And to me, the buttons were a gateway for my growing desire to learn how she communicated intrinsically. Because the more I realized that she was sort of going out of her way to use these words in English to try and tell me what she needed and wanted, the more I was like, oh, I really need to tune in and learn as much as I can so that I can understand what words you might want to use and not just be putting down words that I think you might want to use. So it really sort of facilitated this two-way desire to communicate and started this whole learning journey for me.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you would get comments. I mean, I can understand that perspective, but at the same time, like, the goal is not, you know, Bunny, the talking dog, like, you know, like, you're not taking her out like a, you know, freak show. It is to be able to, at its core, to be able to communicate, to understand, to be able to find those needs, validate those needs, supply those needs. And at the essence of, like, what is a dog? You know, is it just your dog lays there by the fire and you take her out for a walk and, you know, she like chews on some stuff and maybe, you know, digs a little bit versus opening up this, which for me has been super interesting. And I will admit openly, like at first I was very hesitant because people were like, have you seen Bunny? Have you seen Bunny? And I was like, no, I haven't. Like, what is Bunny? And then I was like, I don't know. I don't know about this. But the more that I've like, cause I came with it kind of that scrutinizing, like, is it? But the more that I've watched and the more that I've seen, cause a lot of times it'll say like, or things that are, you know, speaking against it will say, this was prompted or we're jumping to conclusions here. And I'm like, no, this is true. Like you can see the thought process. You can see, you know, obviously the correlation between things, but how is that any different than any other cue that we might prompt for our dogs, except she's allowed to respond back in a certain way. Besides like you ask the cue, the dog does the cue. That's the response. Sometimes the dog doesn't do the cue and you're like, if you're thinking about it, well, why wouldn't you be doing that? Oh, and you run down the list. Are you hungry? Are you upset? Are you scared? Are you, you know, do you need the floor cold? And I think it just opens that communication even further where she can utilize, you know, the ability to be a dog, but then meeting almost halfway with the human. So, and I think, yeah, in the very beginning I was skeptical and then I was like, okay. I love this. Like, because I think at that time as well, what was happening with me is I was coming to kind of my own understanding of language with dogs and using a lot more vocalizations with dogs in the sense of like narrating or talking to my own dogs. And like I said, with Nero, that opening up of like, what do you need? Show me. That was around that time too. And then it just happened that I came across you and I was like, huh, like there's somebody else out there that's talking to their dog. Like, let's see how this goes.
Same, same.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so it's also cultivated a difference with my clients because I started to, around that time again, I started to explore the idea of like using language as a way to normalize things for our dogs and maybe give like a little bit of a heads up on situations.
Oh my gosh, yes. Client
specifically who their dog was not enjoying like rides in the car. And the thing that usually would like spur any sort of negativity for the dog was turning corners. And I was like, well, let's try this. When you're about to turn, when you think you're about to turn, you know, or ahead of time, you can say like turning and see if that helps to relax him a little bit so he can anticipate that it's going to happen. And she came back pretty quickly and she was like, this is working. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. So that just kind of like enveloped other things. So I was watching what I was doing with my dog and then it just kind of snowballed from there. Whereas now it's an intricate part of how I help dogs using language in that way. Opens the door for us to be able to communicate to dogs, even if people are saying like, oh, dogs don't communicate like that. But even the, I think the inflection of your voice is sometimes super, super important, not only for the dog, but for us. And that's anecdotally, again, something I've seen with clients where they're calmer, their approach has softened, their ability to communicate to the dog and feel good about what they're seeing or what they're experiencing all through the way that they're speaking to the dog. And so, yeah, it's just really, it's really interesting. And I hope that it's going to take off even more because a lot of times what I see, which you probably see as well, is like, don't talk to your dog. You're talking to your dog too much. And I'm like, it's bogus. Like you can, of course you can, you know, babble on, but if you're being very distinct with your words and those words have certain associations to things, have you seen a shift in how maybe people are perceptive to language since working with them?
I mean, yeah, I definitely over the years have seen a shift. Naturally, there are always going to be haters online, but I think through some of the work that I've done with Bunny, people are giving their dog more time. They are slowing down. They are narrating more specifically, I mean, narration's been invaluable to us with Bunny's anxiety and sensitivity. Me being able to say, oh, that's a friend human, or that's a stranger human, or that's none of our business, or we're going to go this way now. Let's go in the other direction. Let's move away from blah, blah, blah. I mean, she clearly knows those words because I have seen her levels of anxiety decrease in those situations. So that's been incredibly important to us, being able to tell her what's going on, what's happening next, what she sees and hears, labeling things that she's interested in. If she smells a frog, that's frog. If she is upset by a bird, that's big bird. We don't like big bird. We like small bird. You know, it's very, very plain to see that that's helped us. And I think other people sort of following suit have noticed similar positive changes. And it's kind of weird because I remember there was this somewhat prominent dog scientist once said to me, dogs don't just learn words. And I was like, tell that to anyone who has to spell walkies in front of their dog. They absolutely do learn words. And the brilliant thing about dogs is that because they've been evolutionarily selected for their ability to communicate and connect and cooperate with us, we don't have to train them at all. I'm not saying don't train your dog. I'm just saying that if you bring a dog home and you don't know how to train it and you don't train a single thing, it's going to learn. It's going to learn that you want it to sit before you give it a treat. It will learn. Dogs are smart. This is what they have been bred for and selected for, is for their ability to work with us. So yeah, I think using language seems like a no-brainer to me when it comes to dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that's none of our business.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I use it more as like the therapeutic element rather than, I mean, like there are some things I use with Lycan, like I will teach him, you know, later with things is something that we've done. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, if he's very insistent on doing something now, I'm like, I promise, like later, like we have to like settle, or, you know, we go do something else. But I like I like that none of your business.
That's none of our business. Let's keep going.
Yeah.
It's usually like, that's none of our business this way. And then, yeah, you know, we go the other direction.
Yeah. No, I really like that. Yeah. And I haven't really looked at it that much of like descriptive of that part. And I think that's quite interesting because do you find that she understands when you say like about the frog or the bird, like are those things that you find that kind of carry on for her, like beyond that moment?
Certainly, especially with birds. Like, it is very clear that she does not like the great blue herons, but she does like the small birds. But there are several birds around here that periodically will hear the sound and she'll look at me and I'll say, oh, that's small bird. Doesn't matter. No worries. And she'll be like, oh, okay. You know, she definitely knows many, many more words than she has buttons for. And I don't want 7,000 buttons on our floor. So I try to consolidate. I try to pick words that I think are very, very salient to her experience as a dog. And she has a button with the word other on it. So sometimes there is something she's trying to communicate that she can't, and she'll use the word other. And then it's like a game of charades, right? Like other feel, other play, other animal. Like, what are we trying to get to? But usually the words that we add now are guided by what she's trying to communicate on a regular basis.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course that makes sense. Yeah. I was just imagining like your floor tiled with buttons.
Oh my gosh. Like every step we take is just a mash of like crazy rambling babble sentence.
Yeah. That does seem like that would be. I mean, how do you kind of predict which ones that, like, do you have words that you, like abandon if they haven't been used in a while, or do you just kind of keep them on the roster?
There are some words that I've removed. Like I removed the word Uni, which was the name of our cat who went missing, because it was very painful for me to hear her use it. And some might say that's not ethical. But again, this is a relationship and I have needs, just like Bunny has needs. There was this little toy that was a hippo that she had and it's gone and I haven't found any other hippo toys and it disappeared like 2 years ago. So I removed the hippo button. But generally, once a word makes it onto the board, I generally try to keep it there because I think it would be frustrating to me if somebody gave me the word pizza and then like took it away, right? Yeah. Likewise, if somebody made a board for me and they added the word moist, I would never use it. So, you know, there are words that I'm definitely not going to add. All of the words that I add really need to be salient to her experience as a dog at this point. And if I remove a word, it's either no longer salient to her experience or it's painful for me. Or she just hasn't used it in 3 years and I have limited floor space and, you know, we have to be economical about this.
Yeah.
So, or there's, you know, there are other ways that she communicates that more regularly. So, you know, it's about economy of behavior, but also salience. And we strike a balance just like everything in life. It's important that, we were talking about earlier, everyone's needs are being met. And yeah, that's sort of how we go about things.
Yeah. I'm really sorry about your cat as well. I didn't know that, but yeah, I can imagine that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Don't press that button, please.
Right. Please stop.
Yeah.
I can't take any more heartbreak.
Yeah. It's interesting as well, because I was just reminded of a few times with like adolescent dogs and where buttons have been useful. So sometimes clients come to me and they're like, you know, we're thinking about buttons. What do you think? And I'm like, yeah, like we can try them. And I think where the most kind of, I guess, progress that I've seen has been with adolescent dogs, when it's kind of that, you know, chaotic brain time and they're trying to communicate, but then they're not even sure what they're communicating about, or, you know, all of these kind of needs are mashed in with emotions and hormones. And I think the most progress that I've seen is introducing buttons around that time. And it's interesting because even if it's just like a couple of buttons where they have their primary needs, like maybe outside play, food, something like that, it tends to make a huge difference. And sometimes, well, most of the time, I would say the buttons kind of like, they kind of, you know, find their way out of the equation as the dog gets a little bit older. But it's been interesting to see in those moments where maybe guardians are really, really struggling and they're like, what if we introduce buttons? Or I've said to them, why don't we try to introduce a couple buttons and see how that goes? I think it's really interesting at that time that it helps in that communication aspect, like we were talking about before. And like, you know, when people say like, let the dog be a dog, but in that moment, the dog's like, I don't know how to be a dog. Like, I don't even know anything.
My brain is complicated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That it just allows that in the simplest form to be able to communicate. And yeah, so I would say anecdotally, that's something where I've seen has been a huge benefit, is like adolescent dogs and adding buttons and how clear and simple that can be for the communication for them between the guardian. And it's just, yeah, it's interesting, because I think even without, like, say we didn't have buttons or, you know, whatever, how complicated and such a stressful time, you know, it's usually what, under the age of two, the dogs are relinquished most prominently. Mm-hmm. And so that happens to put us in that prime adolescent period. But yeah, I think it's really interesting that in that respect, at least for me and my practice, to see the adolescent dogs, it allows them that very specific outlet in most cases. I wouldn't say in all cases. Sometimes the dog's like rah, 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 smashing all the buttons, like it kind of looks like what your brain is going through right now. But yeah, has anybody kind of, you know, highlighted where buttons have maybe been more prominent in like their situations?
You know, we've seen a really wide range of ages at which learners start and also have success. My personal experience has been that adolescent boys and buttons are not a good match. Otter and Tenrek have a tendency, well, Otter when he was at peak adolescence, and Tenrek who is now at peak adolescence, have a tendency to just grab the buttons in moments of frustration, grab the tiles and head shake. And then I just like have to take them away for a moment. I'm like, this is not working for you. So I think it absolutely depends on the dog. And I think for some adolescent dogs, yes, a couple of buttons are probably going to take the edge off of that insanity. And for other adolescent dogs, maybe the drivier, higher arousal dogs, maybe that won't be the case. And maybe right after adolescence might be the best time, or start them when they're puppies and then, you know, like restrict access as they're adolescents and then go back to it, because Otter's definitely communicating a little bit more fluidly now that he is coming out of adolescence. So I think it's really case by case, individual. Dogs learn in so many different ways and are motivated by so many different things. And, you know, people teach in so many different ways. There's just like an incredible amount of factors that go into a learner's success with the buttons, you know? So yeah, I think that
and
they're
in everything.
And yeah, just well, yeah, in everything.
Like, yeah, dog
that
behavior
just sums
in
up
general.
Being, yeah, being a person. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's nuanced. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That when you were saying that, I was envisioning, Lycan was, how old was he? I think it was only like 2 years, Nero turned 10. So it was 2 years ago when we tried the buttons. And yeah, he was, he'll be 6. So yeah, he was like 4. So adolescent, you know, in his adulthood, but just could not handle like the button whatsoever. I think he's enthusiastic about everything, but the button was just like... I think there was a frustration when I was trying to teach Nero as well, because Lycan was like, don't you get it? Like outside. And just that intense, like, he was just like all for, I was like, okay, like we're just gonna, yeah, we're gonna put these away. Nero did use them once, actually remembering. But I think what happened is he inadvertently hit it, because we were excited. We were like, outside?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's go outside. And then he never touched them again. So
he's like, I did it.
Yeah.
I did it. Now we're done. Let's move on to the next thing. That's hilarious. Yeah.
Did you know that we offer our expert services worldwide? If you've been looking for a dog professional to help you communicate better with your dog and have the relationship that you've always wanted, check out rplusdogs.com to see what services we offer.
So tell us a little bit about your book. What kind of prompted you to write a book? And for anybody that's kind of like, oh, what would the book be? How would the book like be good for me as like a dog guardian? What would you say?
Yeah. Well, I had never even considered writing a book. Not in my cards whatsoever. And a publisher reached out to me and I was like, oh, well, okay, I'll take a meeting. So I took a meeting with them and they really wanted me to write something that was quite pedagogical. And after thinking about it, I realized that that's not what I wanted to do, because like we were just talking about, there are so many different approaches and there isn't a right way to approach this, because every dog is different. Every human is different. Every situation is different. So I got a literary agent and told them that the type of book I wanted to write was going to be for somebody with ADHD, who's all over the place, but in the best possible way. I'm a human who gets bored really quickly. So when I'm reading a book, I need to feel like I'm learning things. I need to feel like I am going on an emotional journey. I need to be visually stimulated. So it's got a little bit of everything in that regard. And then I said to my literary agent, I don't know how to write a book. What do I do? And they were like, okay, so how about you just write one anecdote from your time with Bunny, and just can be like a page or something. I was like, okay. So I did that. I came back to them with an anecdote and they were like, okay, do that 100 more times. Oh, okay. So I just started thinking back to some of the most impactful moments of our journey and writing those down. And, you know, over a couple of years, it became a book. And I really wanted to talk about my journey going 0 to 100, knowing nothing about behavior and dog training, to where I am now. So I talk a lot about that. I also talk about some of the things that I have learned about myself through working with a dog who is my mirror. She is sensitive and anxious and like sick a lot of the time. And that was my life as well. And so I was able to reflect on a lot of my past experiences with a new level of empathy through a new lens of kindness, self-love, which sounds cheesy, but it really was that. Like, learning how to care for Bunny has taught me so much about how to care for myself. So I talk a lot about that, a lot of things in my past, like an eating disorder that I struggled with. I talk about receiving a diagnosis of autism, which was impacted by my learning journey with Bunny, because I had to learn about AAC, augmentative and alternative communication. And in that journey, so AAC is used primarily with nonverbal humans. And in that journey, learning about it, I started reading about autism in humans and started relating to just about everything I read, and finally spoke to a psychologist about it. And they were like, oh yeah, you're definitely autistic. I was like, oh, I guess it shouldn't have come as much of a surprise to me, but it did. But it really allowed me to reframe some of these experiences in my past and to better understand Bunny. And then there's art in it too, because I'm a visual artist. So I was able to bring back some of the photographers that I most enjoyed working with as a wearable art designer and have them document my relationship with Bunny and Otter and intersperse those throughout the book, which was just so wonderful. It was so wonderful to be able to bring in that visual element. In addition to that, I did a lot of research about prior animal language studies, because Bunny is part of a huge study right now. It's actually the largest citizen science canine cognition study ever attempted. It's going on at the Comparative Cognition Lab at UCSD, headed by Federico Rossano. And there are thousands of active participants and many, many more thousands of enrolled participants and a couple of peer studies under peer review right now, which is really exciting. But reading about some of those prior animal language studies really left me feeling a couple of different ways at once, sort of excited about how this had been attempted so many times and how much we had learned about language through some of these studies, but also left me feeling deeply saddened because, as I mentioned before, dogs have been evolutionarily selected for their ability to communicate and connect and cooperate with us. And all of these prior animal language studies were done with wild animals who have not had that evolutionary history. And so they're taken out of the wild, put in these really sterile environments, and sometimes raised as though they were humans, with not a lot of respect or thought going into their species-specific needs. And quite often, these studies have very, very sad endings. And so I wanted to draw that contrast, and I really wanted to let people know that it's okay to feel two diametrically opposed things at once, because life is full of nuance, and that the most important thing is to remain curious and to remain empathetic. So I think those are sort of the through lines of my book. There's a lot going on in it, but I think it tackles some of those discussions pretty well. And I think it's a high value book in terms that it discusses a lot of the things that I didn't know anything about and have since learned a whole lot about with some decent nuance.
Yeah. No, it's, I, yeah. I'm feeling a lot of emotions at the moment.
Oh.
No, because I think it's, to me, it feels like a pivotal type of book, right? So like how we can, like you were saying before about like learning to care for yourself and that I'm getting emotional, learning to care for you. Cause I feel like, again, it's kind of a similar, you know, having Lycan in my life has taught me so much professionally and personally, and, you know, also doing the job that I do. So like switching to virtual, I was definitely that, you know, professional was like dogs all day, you know, people like, but now I'm like, because people are hard. But now I'm like, God, like I just love working with people so, so, so much. And I think we can be really, really hard on ourselves. And
yeah,
like we talked about before, you know, having your own experience as a sentient being with another sentient being, like it's not going to be perfect. And it saddens me that people feel like they're inadequate if it's not perfect. And then they can mm-hmm. have a lot of, which guilt, I feel like in some ways guilt is inevitable, but at the same time, the guilt that we kind of hold on to about the way that we construct our, you know, either history with our dogs or current situation with it, there's just, you know, enormous amounts of guilt and things like that. But I think mm-hmm. in that respect, you know, being kinder to ourselves in that journey. So I love that you've mentioned that. I'm super excited about the studies. I'm like, that's going to be amazing. That's just, yeah, nerdy me. But that obviously is super, super exciting. So I'm excited about that. I'm kind of like a little sad about, you know, thinking about our relationships, you know, with dogs and how harsh we can be on ourselves, but also just the beauty in what it is to have a relationship, like a real relationship with our dogs. Like mm-hmm. there's nothing else like it. Maybe, you know, partners and things like that too, and family members. But, you know, to be able to open ourselves up into that relationship with another species who, you know, for all intents and purposes, doesn't speak the language and has, you know, a different way of communicating. It's a beautiful thing that does deserve to have kindness and empathy. So yeah, I'm reading the book. I am loving yeah. the book as well. So what you said is in there, like the visuals, stunning, love the visuals. And I think the little segue. So like the one that I've gotten to is like the Jane Goodall, the little segue of that. I think mm-hmm. that's really interesting. And having those kind of peppered throughout the book, like you said, I think I'm also a person that kind of gets bored with things. Like I read studies versus like, you know, I don't read like novels for fun. I'll read
yeah.
like a study or a few studies and I'm like, oh, that was good. You know?
Yeah.
It's like a romance novel to me. I'm like, oh, that's nice. But for me, the moment that I started reading it, I already was like, huh, this is interesting. So learning about you and starting to learn about your journey with Bunny and things like that. And yeah, I really think, and I've not been paid for this endorsement. I really think that it is. I just want to be clear, like you are not paying me, Alexis, but I really think so far, like, it's a fantastic book. And I'm looking for, like I said, I'm looking forward to reading the rest of it this weekend. But I do think that it is something that all dog guardians should read and have that on their kind of roster, you know, because it is that important. It's that important for us to look at that lens of a relationship with a dog in a less traditional sense. And, mm-hmm. you know, for it not to be a non-traditional sense eventually, but to be just the way that things are.
For it to be the standard.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for that endorsement. I really appreciate it.
I am not in any way paid by this promotion, but it's also hard, I think, sometimes with books because it feels like more like a educational experience, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Versus like telling a story. And I think that mm-hmm. that is very difficult to do in a way that also like educates in a way. So I think, yeah, if you're not a writer, I think you definitely are a writer now.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. Now who's getting emotional?
I know. I just get emotional every time we talk about dogs and people. I'm just like, oh, I did say before starting the podcast, I was like, don't cry, Renee. Don't cry.
Aww. It's okay to cry.
I know it's okay to cry. I think it's the first episode I ever may have cried on. So I'm trying to keep that.
Really?
even talking about Lycan. But no, I definitely think it's fantastic. And it's not like any other book that I've read about dogs. And I've read a lot of books about dogs. But it's not like that. So yeah. I definitely look forward to finishing it and putting it on my list of books that I recommend. But thank you so much for doing this with me and sharing, you know, not only your time, but also, you know, more of your journey and more of yourself in this. Is there any last kind of like thoughts, anything that you want to say, anything you want to like get out there that you already already got out there?
I will just let people know where they can find me and what the book is called, since I don't think that we have said that yet. So I am What About Bunny on all social media platforms. And the title of my book is I Am Bunny. And that is officially available. Well, its launch date is next Tuesday. I'm not sure when this is going to air.
I put a date if you,
Okay. Yeah, maybe we need to cut that little bit out. But the launch date is Tuesday. It's available for pre-order now. And I wanted to say thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It has been great to get to know you a little bit better and chat with you. This has just been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for hanging out with us on the Dog Logical Podcast. And if you appreciate the free content that we put out, like this podcast, leave us a review. After all, positive professionals love positive reinforcement. And if you're looking for an ethical, evidence-based dog professional to work with, we're virtual. Check out rplusdogs.com to see what services we offer. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.